Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook.
It's a Friday, and Aloha Friday in the islands, June 7th. From HPR2, it's The Conversation. An A-list you don't want to make.
Financial CPR to kickstart a film breath.
A piece of park to see the forest for the feed.
Immersion up to the aura for terpsichore.
Plus a new Spartan in the backyard, another wrong at Mayor Wright, and the worldview from Al Jazeera.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We started the week with a report of the outbreak of hepatitis A in Hawaii, but that news had ruined Sarah Park's weekend a week ago. The state epidemiologist is leading the investigation in Hawaii, and she got the news first. Now, with the information still surfacing about the infection in our state and several others across the country, Sarah Park may be working through this and many more weekends. We spoke earlier, and I asked her whether a big part of this issue is about the mobility of people, and especially these days, of food.
If you think about it, we're not self-sustainable in terms of food, and so we import a lot of food. Also, our tastes are varied now, you know, in today's day and age. We're very much into sampling foods from various other cultures as well, so add that to the mix. I mean, it's not unheard of to go into a Costco or any store, even your local grocery store, and realize if you look at the labels on the produce even, or any other food product, a lot of it is really being sourced originally from another country, another region of the world, and has traveled a long way to get here, and from areas where their standards may not be quite as high as we'd like, you know. And that said, even domestically, where mobile population, a lot of migrant farm workers and other migrant workers that work in food preparation, food agricultural industry, and so there's potential for entry of pathogens as well through just domestically. And so in this day and age, you know, you're hearing more and more about these sort of foodborne outbreaks, and hepatitis A is one of those things that, you know, thank goodness we actually have a vaccine for it. And back in the late 90s, when it was first developed, we even started vaccinating some of our kids in select states that we knew had a higher risk for getting infected with hepatitis A because of the fact that there were a lot of migrant workers and such. So states like Texas and California were already, since the late 1990s, vaccinating their kids routinely against hepatitis A. And it wasn't until 2006 that we finally decided, okay, we need to do this for the entire nation of kids. And so it was added to the routine childhood vaccinations.
If we're talking about the kid population born 2006 beyond, they've probably been vaccinated?
They've probably been vaccinated as long as they're getting their routine childhood vaccinations.
But mom and dad and everybody else in the family?
May not be, unless they travel to an endemic region like Latin America or Africa or Southeast Asia and did their due diligence to get their travel vaccines before they traveled. You know, so definitely most of our adult population have not been vaccinated. And that's actually a serious concern, especially for the over 40, because it's interesting, this infection, the older you are, the more likely you are to have symptoms and potentially even complications.
Yeah, they get worse the older you get. Isn't that a joy to know?
Isn't that nice?
So at this point, are you going to start a campaign to have people who are, say, 35 and up make sure they have their Hep A vaccination?
I don't know that we're going to start a campaign, but certainly we're recommending, it doesn't hurt to consider it. But, at this point right now, my staff and I, we're focused on just trying to get a grip on this outbreak and try to get an idea of what the real scope of it is and try to control the outbreak itself. I think we can revisit sort of the general population later, but at the same time, I'm not going to overlook this opportunity to also let people know, consider it, in the future, maybe let this die down a little.
Some of these things that, for example, the berries, they're not necessarily just going to homes. A lot of people who have smaller restaurants and little stands are going to shop Costco, too.
Right.
So
right.
It means it's entering it into the population from not only home, but, maybe your neighborhood smoothie shop.
Yeah, no, and that's a definite concern, not just here in Hawaii, but on the mainland, a big concern. In the conference calls I'm on with other states on the mainland, we've all expressed that concern, and it's a challenge to try and figure out where the risks are for, those mom-and-pop shops, because no one tracks that. Costco, there's business memberships, but that doesn't mean, a lot of us are Costco members, and how many of us go to Costco, might have a business and purchase products for our business, but at the same time are purchasing for personal use. And so trying to figure out who's buying for what, it's a real mess. And so the hope is that we just try to get the message out there so the businesses realize, and hopefully they'll do their, they'll do their part and notify customers or put a notice out on their, storefronts to let people know so that they can take precautions or be aware. Trying to track down each and every one, every mom and pop store.
Yeah, you're never
going to
be able to do that.
Yeah.
And you just can only, as you say, hope that they're going to be forthright
right.
and upfront about it and not be so scared that perhaps they're going to right. scare away clientele because they are admitting that they use this
right.
antioxidant.
And, I mean, honestly, if they're forthright, I would hope their customers would appreciate that because they're being honest. And honestly, it's not their fault. FDA and CDC are still investigating, and they don't have a good sense just yet. It's still early days in the investigation, not just here in Hawaii, but nationally, and there's a lot of information that is flooding into CDC, and they're, from all of us states, and they're trying to make heads or tails of. So hard to say.
Sarah, so where are we with those two cases that we had on
Three.
Oahu? Two on
Oahu, yes.
And the one on Kauai,
right.
And there were two more that were being investigated. And give us an update.
Yeah, so we actually have three cases confirmed. That means that they definitely have or had hepatitis A infection, and they definitely consumed the implicated product. We have one case on the Big Island, apparently, that also had hepatitis A infection but ate a different product. So we're looking at that one closely. That's one we call a probable case. And then we have five additional cases around the state on all the islands. So there's at least one case on each island right now that we're looking at. We're investigating more closely to determine. We know that they've got hepatitis A infection, but we don't know. We're still trying to figure out, make contact with them in terms of, and getting them to go through, working with Costco and working with the persons to try and determine did they actually purchase product or not. So it's keeping us pretty busy, obviously, across the state. All the investigators on the neighbor islands, as well as here on Oahu, our laboratorians and our sanitation folks, trying to follow up everything.
To say nothing of the people who are looking at this and hearing what you just had to say about that other probable case with a different, different product, and wondering what that could be. Are we going to get a real quick answer as to what that product is yet?
Oh, it was a Townsend product as well, so that's why it's a probable. So we're just sort of, like I said, FDA and CDC are not leaving anything mm-hmm. out in terms of possibility, but right now the concern is we know from looking at all the cases across the states that implicated product, the organic antioxidant berry blend, is definitely associated with most of the cases okay. identified right now. The question is, you never want to exclude too early potentially others that may be related to this cluster or may be related to something else. We don't know.
which kind of makes the case that if you're at all concerned about this, you might want to talk to your doctor about getting vaccinated. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Okay, take care.
You too. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Sarah Park is the Hawaii State Epidemiologist and Chief of the Disease Outbreak Control Division. She directs all activities concerning emerging infections, disease surveillance, investigations, immunizations, and public health preparedness. More about hepatitis A is on our website, hpr2.org.
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. Later in the show, getting the coin to get the camera rolling and another run at Mayor Wright Housing and some of your letters. But first, chart-topping in the backyard.
Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, ohangai.
Honolulu's Mary Knoll High School is alma mater to Jasmine Trias, a finalist on the third season of American Idol. The 2004 alumna began her journey on the reality show by singing Whitney Houston's Run to You, and she ended up with a Universal Records deal. Her debut album went gold on Asian charts and platinum in the Philippines, and after that, she became a major star there. As the Manila Times raved, everyone wants Jasmine, but Trias she's not the only famous singer who has been associated with Mary Knoll. In February, a Hawaii-born former pop star was appointed to an administrative position at Mary Knoll. And so for today's backyard quiz, we're asking if you can name this celebrity. He or she charted number one on Billboard back in 1990. We'll send you to this famous vice principal's office a little later in the class.
Aloha. I'm Sherry Broder from the John Van Dyke Institute of International Law and Justice. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
As they develop their craft, filmmakers soon discover that they're going to have to learn a bit about fundraising to get their projects off the ground. They're going to have to come out from behind the camera and find a way to raise a serious amount of money. But there's hope for filmmakers these days. It's called Kickstarter, and it offers movie makers with a vision an opportunity to test the strength of their ideas. John Brecky's idea for a film called The Breath to Survive is in the final hours of Kickstarter fundraising, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Chris.
Like most filmmakers, you'd like to be shooting, you'd like to be writing, you'd like to be on the set, working with actors. Were you surprised when you became a movie maker how much time you're going to have to spend getting the money to do what you do?
Absolutely. It's 1,000 times more time-consuming to both get the money and also get, you know, crew at lower than normal, you know, wages to help you.
And I'm sure that you've had this feeling many times of, you know, I just want to shoot this thing. Can I just shoot my script? Why does it have to be so hard, right?
Yeah. I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think at the end of it, you know, some good fortune was going to come across me and my cast and my crew so mm-hmm. that, you know, we can all do more of this a little easier.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's set the stage a little bit. You have a film in the can.
Yeah.
Written by you, shot and directed by you. And what's the specific goal of this latest Kickstarter fundraising that you're doing?
We showed the near-finished film to some Hollywood professionals, experienced producers, and they really suggested that I add this new opening scene to the movie. And I knew right away that I should as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a matter of that. But, you know, I was pretty burned out financially and also just creatively. It was just hard for me to think about the fact of doing it. Like you said, it's so hard.
But, you know, that's an interesting part of the filmmaking process because it is exhausting. But also, toward the end of getting a script, realize you probably lose a little bit of perspective yourself, right? You've got the thing shot. And that's why notes, I've had other filmmakers ask me for notes on script because they say, I don't have any distance from this anymore, right?
This film enabled me to grow and to polish in ways that I liken to a wood carver sculpting a Buddha out of a tree trunk.
Uh-huh.
And I've been very fortunate with a lot of artists and a lot of gifts, and this opening scene's one of them. And so, yeah, you're right. This has taken a year to polish,
uh-huh.
And a lot of gifts have come along the way. So,
And this particular polish is people giving you notes that said you might want to have a little more establishing of one of the key sort of motivation situations in your plot, right?
Yeah, you know, it's called A Breath to Survive. It's about a woman who unplugs from society and discovers the art in life.
Uh-huh.
And we needed to understand the stress a little bit more so we could enjoy the ride.
Why she unplugged and what the pressures were on her, that kind of thing.
And ironically, as you said, I'm revisiting my stress that led me to write this story while I get ready to shoot this open. I'm remembering.
Well, obviously, it came from a place inside you, right?
Yeah.
As any worthwhile idea does.
And so, about the perspective, uh-huh. I needed to get this far away from it to actually reenact that new opening scene.
Yeah. Well, and that's a function of the passage of time.
Yeah.
Right? You've got the thing shot. It's in the can. You've had some time to ponder it. And that's fairly common in a movie-making experience to sort of, if 6 months down the line, say, need a scene here, maybe a couple of shots there, right?
Absolutely. I think that, I don't think any professional producer or director is above and beyond a reshoot.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you need them and sometimes you don't.
Well, it's also, I think you really, you know, it's such a collaborative art. You were telling me about how much you'd learned from a sound designer that you work with. And you have to draw on people who have specialties beyond your specialties, right? I mean,
absolutely.
You're a writer, you're a shooter, you're a director, but you've got to give things like music and sound design off to somebody else.
Absolutely. Emmy Award-winning sound designer. How many times does a local Hawaii filmmaker get a chance to work with somebody like that? It took my first Kickstarter success fundraising to be able to have that experience.
Mm-hmm.
But that does not diminish the local experts that help paint these pictures. DP, guys like Robbie Rip, Greg Doy, Scotty Lissiter. I got a makeup artist like Tania Kahale who works on some of the biggest national things, and they help local artists like me. And without that, the picture wouldn't have been good enough to go to the sound designer.
Well, but you've got to be able to also surrender a certain amount of creative control because you're not a makeup artist, right?
Yeah.
So you've got to be able to say, I need something that works. I don't really know how it's achieved, but this is what my goal is. And then trust the makeup artist or the sound designer, the other specialists, right?
You know, this is shot in the red, which is 4x HD quality. And I guarantee you that if I didn't have an expert makeup artist like Tania Kahale, you'd be able to see the makeup.
Oh, HD has created all kinds of havoc for makeup artists, haven't it? Because you can just see every pore now.
Yeah, but in this film, it's perfect.
That's great.
You know.
So, really, the home stretch, right? You're going to get this scene. The Kickstarter funding is working, right? You're on track.
Yeah, we made our goal. People can still go to A Breath to Survive Kickstarter.com and help contribute because we're still using the money to pay the colorist and things like that. We're going to finish this scene, cut it pretty quickly because the movie's already scheduled for a release VIP cast and crew at Kahala Theater on July 11th.
Uh-huh. Oh, boy. You are under the gun, actually.
And it'll be my first Blu-ray surround sound experience.
Uh-huh. Well, this is pretty exciting, right?
Yeah.
How many years has it been?
This film's been 2 years.
From script to shooting to...
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. Maybe an extra month or two.
Which is actually not bad for a feature film from soup to nuts, right?
I think it's about normal. Some people think that it's taken forever. But
it just seems that way, Josh. That's because you haven't any distance from it yet.
Yeah.
But you will, and it's great to talk to you, and good luck with the project.
Yeah, Thank you for your time.
We'll look forward to watching this.
Aloha.
John Brecky's film, A Breath to Survive, is in the final hours of its final Kickstarter fundraising effort, and you can learn more about it on our HPR2 website, hpr2.org.
Doctor, doctor, what's the remedy? So many questions. If your dream is just a dream, tell me, preacher.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travasa Hana, an experiential resort with daily flights to Hana on Mokulele Airlines, celebrating Hawaii through adventure, culinary, culture, fitness, and spa programs. Travasa.com/Hana.
Guitarist Jeff Peterson headlines a special concert in Windward Community College's Palikou Theater on Sunday, August 4th at 4 p.m. Jeff Peterson and Friends features Hoku Award winner Nathan Aveau, jazz ukulele virtuoso Benny Chong, and classical guitarist Ben Verdery. Tickets are available to HPR members only until June 15th. Go to hawaiipublicradio.org and click on events. To order by phone, call 955-8821.
Support for The Conversation comes from the First Unitarian Church of Honolulu, located at 2500 Pali Highway, committed to growing compassion and joy in Hawaii for 60 years. Learn more at unitarians.org.
HPR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Amy Mitsuda of Honolulu, Donald Mayer and Joan Yanagihara of Ka'ava, and Jacqueline Miller of Honolulu for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. It's 8:28. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. There's worry at Mayor Wright. Residents of the housing project in downtown Honolulu fear the plan to renovate the complex might mean they could lose their homes. That's causing a ruckus among residents, their supporters, and state housing officials. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's reality check of the latest dust-up. Hey, Chad.
Happy Friday, Beth Ann.
Yeah, good Friday for us, because we're heading into a weekend, but still there's a lot of concern over at Mayor Wright, no matter what day of the week it may be, that they may not have their homes if all the plans go through the way they might happen, and might is really the operative word. Is this just a lot of miscommunication and fear-mongering, or is there really something to be upset about?
I think there's truth on both sides, a little overreaction, a little reasonable fear. You know, there's two options, really, on what to do with Mayor Wright. I mean, it's an old facility. You either rehabilitate it or you tear it down and build something new. Either way, that's going to require taking people out of their units while that work is being done. And then what do you do if you have what's known as a mixed-use facility? That's kind of the goal. That means you can have folks of different income levels in the same facility. Could that mean, though, that if you're paying the very minimum right now, that you wouldn't get back into that facility once it's all repaired? I mean, I spoke to somebody who's paying $361 a month.
Wow.
For a three-bedroom, she can't afford to pay any more than that. Where is she going to go in this tenant market, this rental market, to pay that kind of coverage for her rental? She's got three kids. She's a single mom.
Well, earlier in the week, we had Drew Astolfi on the show, the executive director for Faith Action for Community Equity. He
right.
seemed very positive about whatever would happen with Mayor Wright, and that the more logical answer might be to rebuild the whole thing, because then you can actually create something that's going to work now and going to the future, as opposed to just the rehab money that will have to be shot down that line. And although there have been some, good improvements, like hot water that everybody got.
Yeah, hot water is still flowing there.
Yeah,
I spoke to Drew. Yeah, I spoke to Drew this morning, and there is some good news to report. He's going to be meeting with Hakeem Owen Safi. He's head of the Public Housing Authority. They're going to meet on Monday and work some of this stuff out. There has been a lot of miscommunication. I think there is a general agreement that something needs to be done. I think the main thing is to include everybody, have all voices heard, all sides considered, and make sure that those tenants have their fears mitigated.
Because a lot of it is about that right of return. And although, Drew says that under the Federal Uniform Relocation Act, that guarantees somebody help in finding new housing, it doesn't mean they're going to be back in the same place where they started. And that seems to be where all this kerfuffle is centering.
A reasonable kerfuffle at that.
All right. Thanks, Chad. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.
Thank you, Beth Ann. You too.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2, Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook. Coming up, an urban forest idea that may bear fruit and garden aisle bunheads.
Hey, it's Friday. That means we get a chance to look at Monday and beyond for next week. Bill Dorman from Hawaii Public Radio's news department, our news director, is here to have a look at what's coming up for the news department. And it's summer, almost, sort of, kind of.
It is. It's sort of unofficially here already, later this month officially. But, a lot of programs sort of go along with that. And there's one in particular that we're going to take a look at next week involving military families, and particularly kids. There's so many unique challenges for families who face the deployment of a parent, and a whole nother set when that parent returns. Now with the involvement in Afghanistan winding down, it's increasingly about family reunification and some of the challenges, as well as moving to other locations. Each of those situations has sort of challenges of its own, and there's a program that's being jointly run by UH and the YMCA that helps address some of those issues. Grew out of this Operation Military Kids initiative. And so we're going to look at the program and meet a military family, actually, who is themselves on the move from Hawaii, from Salt Lake, actually, down to Texas. Bunch of kids, logistics, emotions, all wrapped up. And it's an interesting time for a lot of these folks and a program that helps that.
Deeply emotionally charged, talking about going from Hawaii and Salt Lake to Texas.
Yeah.
That's going to be a culture shock.
Yeah, it's a different world and a different set of challenges, again, from a parent who is deployed to a parent who returns, and then you pull up stakes and move again.
Yeah, layer upon layer of challenge.
Exactly.
And for kids, that's tough, although they're pretty resilient creatures.
It's true. And boy, speaking of resiliency, we've got a story next week on the Big Island. What if you were given extra years of life? There are a lot of colorful folks on the Big Island, as we all know. One of them is Earl Bakken. He's the guy who invented the pacemaker many years ago, co-founder of the medical equipment company Medtronic. Now he's got a program going for people whose lives have been extended because of medical devices. So whether that's a pacemaker, an insulin pump, could be any number of items that have let you live longer than you already would have. And the question is, what have you done with the extra years of your life?
Whoa, what a deeply philosophical bent for something that began as a medical industry.
And for the folks who have been doing good works, got a little bit of a contest going. They're looking for 10 people to live on, give on. Great program.
Our own group of great philanthropists, because they got some extra life to actually go out and do it.
Yeah, Earl himself.
Oh, looking forward
to
that story.
Yeah.
Very much so. Thanks, Bill. Have a good weekend. Bill Dorman is the news director for Hawaii Public Radio.
Got a box full of letters. Think you might like to read. Some things that you might like to see, but they're all addressed to me.
And we've got some letters to read with you because, hey, it's Friday and that's what we do. After our conversation about the natatorium, the discussion continued on Facebook. Dennis O'Shea wrote in to say, remember, too, that the pool is the memorial. The gateway is merely a gateway. So, one, moving the gateway and demolishing the pool doesn't preserve the memorial. And two, you can't move the gateway anyway because the gateway is because of the way it's constructed. You'd have to build a replica, and that's not preservation either.
Following the Science Camp segment with Mike Richards, we received this memory from Jesse Weinberger. I really enjoyed the Science Camp segment of the conversation. When I was 15, I attended a six-week NSF, National Science Foundation, summer science program. I learned a lot that summer. My experience changed my career goal. I was going to be a geologist, the topic of the session, but during the camp, I realized that my interests were more about chemistry, and that's what I went to college to study. I ended up with a BS in biochemistry, and I've enjoyed many truly interesting and important jobs ever since.
And after yesterday's conversation with now former editor of the Honolulu Weekly, Mindy Pennybacker, Tim Rule sent us this email. Lori Carlson can be vicious, and I know this firsthand, but if I wanted someone to save a newspaper, I would choose only her. Certainly not Dennis Francis. And when Lori closes shop, it is over. Relying on faith at this stage is choosing bankruptcy and screwing creditors, like many silly people do when they don't want to admit they failed.
And right after last night's Town Square, this was in our email inbox from Esben Borsting. Great show today with Mr. Roth and Mr. Slater. I had a comment I wanted to post, but I thought better of it. I really wish they'd answered my question today. To hide behind their pseudo-legal position doesn't really make the best case for them. However, I did rather enjoy that Mr. Slater basically blew his whole argument out of the water by going to the fear-mongering approach. To even ask the question whether or not the people of Honolulu are ready to trust the lives of their daughters to a driverless train was just despicable. Either they are withholding some data they have about how incredibly dangerous trains are compared to car travel, or they are completely full of it. The sad part is they're hoping the train really is a death machine. Great job on the show. You have far more restraint than I, and I applaud you, Ms. Kozlovich.
Thanks for the letters. Our Facebook page is Hawaii Conversation, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's a pie-shaped park you may have passed as you enter downtown Honolulu near the Kukui Plaza. There's nothing much to catch your eye, but soon that may change, with a little something for your stomach, too. An edible garden is on the drawing board. David Acheson is a member of the Food Forest Citizens Working Group, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
You know, that little park, I stopped to think about it when I was reading through all the materials and the plans that you would like to see happen in that place. But that little park is so nondescript. You go right by it. You'd never really even know that there's a space there where you could do anything like this. You live in the neighborhood. Obviously, you must have looked at it one day, too, with some friends and thought, there could be a program here.
That's right. I live just a block away from the park. And people use it kind of to walk through, but not a lot of people stay in it because it's not a real attractive place right now.
Oh, heck, it's ugly.
Okay, yeah, you could call it that. But when I walked through and I saw all the hexagonal planters just empty, they just kind of call out to me, plant me. And, you know, I've been working with some permaculture folks on the island, and that's probably a whole other show to explore permaculture. But essentially, there's a lot of great work going into training people on permacultural principles. And part of that means working with natural processes and involving us to restore landscapes and the land while we also produce food from it and other benefits. And so I think we've got a real opportunity here to plant food-producing trees and shrubs in this park, make it a more beautiful community space, and also send a message about what we can do.
And a message not far from the Capitol, considering where this is located.
That's right. I mean, the location of Kamali'i Park, people have asked us, you know, why there? And when we've been talking with parks, they have said, how about this other place? But we've really come back to Kamali'i Park because not only can it be a great amenity for all the residents that are right there, but there's also some social service organizations right there dealing with issues of mental health and homelessness. They're on board, too. So we've partnered with them. And we really think that's another benefit of this project, another yield, if you will, of Kamali'i Park Food Forest.
You're not just talking about what you can produce. You're also creating a place for some, you know, real psychological benefits of gardening.
That's right. And the training also potential that goes with it for folks that are served by, say, Institute for Human Services and Mental Health, Kokua. So it's a real community project, too, in that the Downtown Neighborhood Board has taken a close look at this, and we've been able to brief them. And they've said this has been a problem park for decades. This is the best idea we've seen come along in that time. We want to see it happen.
But to make it happen, that means there's going to have to be some money attached to that. And although there is this $50 million that supposedly is supposed to be going into 50, this project. I'm sorry, did I say 60?
50 million, you said. Yeah.
Oh, did I? Oh,
that's okay.
You know, only, if only.
If only, yes.
But $50,000 that is supposed to go into the program but hasn't been released yet, and days
right.
are running short.
Yes, the city council last year did appropriate $50,000 in the budget for the project, specifically for the project at Kamali'i Park. So that part of the city is saying, you know, go. Yes, we like the idea. In that time, we've been talking with parks and recreation, and they've been cautiously optimistic along the way, but have had some concerns. The back and forth has taken kind of a long time. So here we find ourselves at the end of the fiscal year, essentially. And the project still hasn't gotten the green light from parks, and therefore the money has not been released. Now, one thing I would like to say about the money is that because of all the partners that we have on board and the community support has been so phenomenal, if it becomes impossible to get that money, we're not there yet. We hope that it can be released. But if it's impossible, we're not going to give up. I mean, I think the community, through other means, could potentially raise the funds to make this happen anyway. It's too good an idea to walk away from.
Other ideas like, you know, crowdfunding and people who want to make specific donations to you directly, all those kinds of things. But isn't, you know, in saying, you know, we're not giving up and we're not going to rely on this $50,000, see, I said at the right the time,
right.
$50,000. That's basically saying we don't need that $50,000 and telling them not to worry about it?
Well, there is the danger that if I raise that point that it's perceived in that way. But I think it's with all the issues swirling around between the mayor and the council over budget issues right now, we understand that even though our funding was already approved, that it could be kind of wrapped up in this. And that combined with being so close to the end of the fiscal year, we don't want people to conclude that if the money's not released, oh, the project can't happen. So that's what I'm saying. If it becomes impossible to release that money, we're still on. We're still a go if the Parks Department and the mayor see fit to give a green light to this project. And we can seek funds in other ways or in another round with the city council.
So both. Most immediately, what's on your time horizon now? Because obviously you're sandwiched between those two entities, and until you get a definitive answer, you're sort of in limbo land. But what do you see happening
right.
by the time we reach midsummer?
Well, if we get approval for the project, what you're going to see is laying the groundwork for the actual planting project that depending on how, if we do need to do some fundraising, depending on how it goes, would be this fall. Fall would be a good time to get the area planted out before more rains come. So you'll see a lot of community engagement, finalizing the plans, working it out with parks specifically on some of the planting issues, kind of a back and forth. You know, we want them to be our partner. So I think you'll see excitement growing leading up to the actual sort of barn raising style of getting the thing planted out with a lot of volunteer labor.
Which a lot of people say might just be your best shot in getting many hands to do, you know, like making light work, but also getting the buy-in of many hearts. There's nothing like putting a little sweat equity into something, and also, you know, a few shekels from your pocket doesn't hurt either.
Right.
It's kind of what happens around here when we have lots of people give a little bit of money. We get radio. You're going to get a garden and a pilot program that may, in fact, spin off into many other parks that are just as barren as Kamali'i Park and might very well find their way into being an edible forest, too. Thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you for having
me. Good luck with the project.
Can I just say KamaliiPark.org is where people could go to learn more?
You know, we'll have all of that on our website so they can find everything about
you
right there. And thanks, David, for coming in. David Atchison is a web manager by trade, and he's also the Transition Oahu Board officer and core member of the Food Forest Citizens Working Group. He's a resident of downtown and lives just a block from the park where a food forest may soon grow. More about it is on our website, hpr2.org.
Take me outside, sit in the green garden. Nobody out there, but it's okay now. Bathe in the sunlight, don't mind if rain falls. Take me outside, sit in the green garden.
Oh, wow.
Earlier in the show, we told you about 2004 Mary Knoll High School grad Jasmine Trias attaining international stardom after she won a finalist position on American Idol's third season. Her first album went gold in Asia and platinum in the Philippines, and now she may have been Mary Knoll's most successful musician, but definitely not the first. Another Mary Knoll alum started his career in 1988, covering George Benson's Nothing's Gonna Change My Love for You. It reached number 12 on Billboard's Hot 100. And 2 years later, his duet with Bobby Brown, She Ain't Worth It, reached number 1 on the same chart. We also told you this famous Mary Knoll grad became vice principal of his alma mater in February, and we wanted to know who he is. Well, class, that would be Glenn Medeiros. If you have a quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
She's nothing but trouble.
When you look at photographs of young dancers on stage, there's an image that comes back to you again and again, one of intense concentration. You can't be halfway involved in a dance performance. Only total immersion will do. Jennifer Schwartz Bell Gray knows the value of starting dance training early. She started at 3 in Hong Kong and won a position at the Royal Ballet School in London at age 11. She teaches now at her Kauai Dance Center, which is giving a performance tonight, and she's on the phone with us. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning, Chris. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, sure. You were once a pretty small dancer yourself, weren't you?
I was, yes.
In fact, it sounds like you were tiny when you started. What was that like?
Well, I have to say I watched this brilliant production of Swan Lake when I was 3 years old.
Uh-huh.
With the Royal Ballet, and because, of course, I was living in Hong Kong at the time. They broadcast this in.
Uh-huh.
It was Natalia Makarova and Anthony Dow.
Oh, boy.
And when I saw this, I was riveted and said, that's what I'm going to do.
You know, I often wonder how many dancers, either from the movie The Red Shoes or a performance of Swan Lake or Nutcracker, got started. Those three seem to have sent millions to dance, yeah?
Yes, very popular.
Well, what was it like for you? You know, it must have been exciting, but also pretty scary for a little girl.
Well, it was, I have to say, I didn't know what I was getting myself into.
Yeah.
When I was very young and watching the ballet, you don't realize how much rehearsal is needed. And I really, I loved music, and I was such so responsive to music to the point where I really believed at that young age that everyone on stage was copying each other. I had no idea the hours and hundreds of hours of work and technique training and everything that was involved. It was really a huge learning curve.
But, you know, that childlike feeling that everybody is just sort of moving spontaneously is kind of what you want to achieve, in the sense that you don't want the seams to show. You don't want to know.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Yep, that's absolutely it. That's the business of ballet, to make it look seamless, effortless, and beautiful.
Yeah, and to sort of disguise all those hundreds of hours of work.
That's true.
But at the same time, when you're teaching kids, you've got 80 kids performing tonight.
We have 80, I would say 80 performers, right from 3 years old right through to adults. So everybody in between. We are a school that facilitates students of all ages and all abilities in classical ballet, hip-hop, contemporary, lyrical, and modern dance.
Well, and with all of those people, Jennifer, you face the thing, you know, they've all got to go through that journey that you went through, which is one of finding out, perhaps to their surprise, just how hard they're going to have to work. Right?
Yes.
And how much total immersion, because it is about immersion in dance. There's no other way, right?
There's no other way.
So how do you sell that idea to, you know, a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, or you know, an adolescent? How do you get through to them that, you know, you're going to have to do a lot more work than you thought you were going to?
Well, I think it's like everything else, you know, in baby steps.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I would have wanted to know all that was before me when I was 3. It just has to unfold naturally as it does. And
I think you're probably right about that. Mm-hmm. You don't want to say this is going to overwhelm you, because then it'll overwhelm you.
Oh, well, no one can know. And most times, you're not really sure at that age what you really want to do until you try it. So that was my journey, and of course there's a lot of other people who begin, and maybe they don't go all the way and do all the training, but nonetheless they still acquire the benefits of dance, because there's so much to acquire from it.
And what are those benefits, Jennifer?
Well, for a start, it helps you to gain focus, concentration, mm-hmm. body awareness, camaraderie, learning how to work in groups,
mm-hmm.
learning how to hold yourself with poise,
yeah.
developing your confidence, your self-esteem, how you present yourself, very many of the benefits of that come through from dance.
Well, and so many performing arts skills are like that, don't you think? I mean,
absolutely.
You don't have to become a sword swallower.
No, not at all. If everyone can immerse themselves in it to whatever degree they feel. And I think that's what's so wonderful. That's why the arts need support, because there's a lot of people who would really like to do more of it, but maybe don't have the opportunity for one reason or another.
So I would figure that you tell your students at some point, do you kind of tell them, you know, you don't have to go all the way to becoming a professional dancer, but this is going to inform your life, enrich your life in ways you haven't expected. Do they sort of see that coming? Do you prepare them for that?
Yes, I do. And also, I lost my train of thought just now, but sorry, would you say that again? Because there was something really important I wanted to say, just following on what you said.
Well, just the whole idea of getting people to understand that no matter whether or not they stay with it forever, it's going to enrich their lives.
Yes, and the point is, if you're going to do it, do it with all your heart, all your soul, and really, really enjoy the moment.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to do it to your best of your ability.
So while you're in it, be
yes,
in it all
be
the way.
Completely present.
You know, that's that lesson can apply to a great many other things, don't
yes,
you think, Jennifer?
Yes, exactly. That's why it's so transferable.
Well, it's I wish you all kinds of luck with your performance tonight. You've got 80 kids on stage. That's going to be pretty exciting and a logistical challenge
well,
for you.
I just wanted to mention it wasn't just a children's performance because it's really quite exceptional in the event that there's a multimedia light show and it's
well, we'll send people your way through our website, Jennifer. Thanks very much for talking with us. Jennifer Schwartz-Belgray is the co-founder of Kauai Dance Center, which is putting on Magic of Dance in Emotion, featuring 80 student dancers this afternoon at 5 at the War Memorial Convention Hall in Lihue, and details are on our website, hpr2.org.
From open spaces to very closed ballet spaces, we've had a nice half hour.
Exactly,
going
yeah.
into the weekend with some good things to think about.
Well, I always applaud any effort to create open recreational space in a city because cities have to breathe. You know, there's got to be little patches of earth, patches of sky, and it helps. It helps a great deal.
Well, that patch at Kamali'i Park isn't breathing; it's just baking.
Exactly.
We'll see what can happen with that as we move closer to midsummer and see if, in fact, we get people down there planting away. Well, that's going to do it for us for this week. Coming up next week, the conversation goes off to Maui. From Wednesday through Friday, I'll be broadcasting from the offices of FIM Group in Kahului.
And I'll be right here on Kaheka Street. So, how many butterfly farmers do you know? We'll meet one on Maundy.
Meanwhile, you can talk back to your radio. You can find the show on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or me at Because HPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. Our executive producer is Bethann Kosovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Maddie DeShazo is our production assistant. And Andy Walters, Alex Ellenberg, and Rylan Suahisa are our summer interns.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. Have a good weekend. I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Bethann Kosovich. We'll all meet you on Monday when we pick up the conversation.